Hey, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, a weekly radio show celebrating the cultural heritage of the American worker.
We're a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Chris Garlock.
I'm Elise Bryant.
Elise, welcome back. You have been traveling.
Yes, I have, and I had a great time.
Malta. We're going to have to hear more about Malta, but that's for another.
And the trade unionists in Malta, who we met with.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. And hopefully you brought us back some labor songs from Malta.
No, but I bought some labor other things.
Other things. All right, folks, stay tuned. Stay tuned. All right, we have a fabulous show for you this week. Hey, have you seen American Fiction yet?
I have not seen it. It's on my list of must see before the week is over.
I tell you what, I've seen it. I'll go back and I'll see it again. It is that good.
Oh yeah.
Seriously. Book us into the AFI right now. Anyway, we have a terrific interview with Cord Jefferson, the writer-director. He's going to take us behind the scenes, talk about the challenges of adapting this book and creating Black-centered narratives. And it's just a really great interview. It's from the WGA podcast.
Something that I really thought a lot about when I came to writing American Fiction was the idea that you have this book that you love, but you need to change it pretty drastically in order to make it a movie, you know, and you can't sort of hew so closely to the text. You have to make some decisions that are going to change things.
And then in our second segment, you want to tell them about the second segment?
Yes. We're going to hear from one of our local heroes and one of the founding fathers of the Labor Heritage Foundation, organizer, musician Joe Uline. He's going to tell us the story behind the song Hands.
And he turns and points to a big gun rack that was right by the front door. He said, if you're here to talk about the union, that's what you're going to meet. And he points to his guns. Now, leaning up against the gun rack was a guitar. And so I shifted the conversation immediately to the guitar.
That's all coming up on today's Labor Heritage Power Hour. But first, Elise, I was thinking about a Cesar Chavez quote, you are never strong enough that you don't need help. And I was kind of thinking that that applies to the fundraising that we're doing now for WPFW because, you know, PFW is pretty strong.
Yes, and it's strong because of all the people who are willing to volunteer their time and efforts and the members out there who are willing to support this wonderful, powerful Jazz with Justice station, one of a kind in our area for sure.
And Sister Katia came up with a terrific motto for this pledge drive that we're in right now.
Yeah.
Revolutionary radio for revolutionary times.
I like it.
It sounds like we could do a song about that. I mean, you know,
it
if
does.
You were so inclined.
I'll share it with Steve Jones and Peter Jones. They'll probably come up with something quick.
There you go. There you go. Let's bring in the people who actually know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks. 1-800-222-9739, or you can go on WPFWFM.org and click on donate now. 100-222-9739. WPFWFM.org or on Cash App, $WPFW. Revolutionary radio for revolutionary times.
Yeah. That's it.
All right. What do you say? Should we go to the show?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Hey, this is Bob Odie from Million Dollar Organizer. We're proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
Any news?
Editors, they want a black book.
They have one. I'm black, and it's my book.
Look at what they expect us to write.
Would you read an excerpt?
Yo, Sharonda, where you be going in a hurry like that? If and you gots to know, I's going to the pharmacy.
Oh, when you're living on faith, something's got to give.
If they want stereotypes, I'll give them one.
What is this?
Deadbeat dads, rappers, crack, and black, right?
Nobody's gonna publish this.
Just wanna rub their noses in it.
We love it.
What?
It is very,
black?
Yes, that's it. I'm happy you said it and not me.
Welcome to Third and Fairfax.
official podcast of the Writers Guild of America West. Next up, host Hilliard Guest speaks with screenwriter and director Cord Jefferson about his acclaimed new film, American Fiction.
What's up, everybody? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest. I am the co-chair of the Committee of Black Writers, as well as the Writers Education Committee. So let's welcome to the show, everybody, my man, Cord Jefferson, out here killing the game big time. All my friends are super jealous of you, Cord, just killing the game. Coming in 5, 6, 8 years, next thing you know, you Oscar nominated and stuff. And every once in a while, God gives somebody that little fairy dust. So people are coming to take your legs, Cord. They're taking your legs.
I hope not. There's enough to spread around. I feel like there's enough fairy dust out there.
Exactly. Hey, man, welcome to the show, everybody. Like I said, Cord Jefferson, Emmy winner, WGA Award, NAACP, Audience Award at TIFF. We could keep going. So many good things going on for y'all. His new movie, American Fiction, we're just going to jump right on in. Cord, so yes, let's just go back a little bit. Just tell everybody a little bit about you, how you got into the game, and like how you started writing. How did all that come about?
So I was a journalist for about 8 or 9 years immediately after college. I worked at a variety of different places. I worked in New York and LA. For a time, I was in DC doing some political reporting. So I was bouncing around always as a journalist, but I always had, you know, ambitions of becoming, you know, just a writer, a more general kind of writer. I wanted to write books. I was interested in writing screenplays, but particularly Hollywood felt like I didn't have any family in it. I didn't know anybody. I didn't really have any friends in the industry. And so I think that if you don't have access to it in that way, it can feel kind of impenetrable. And so I was always like, well, I would love to write a screenplay one day, but I have no idea how I would even begin to do that. And then fortunately, a guy named Mike O'Malley, who was the showrunner on a show called Survivor's Remorse, he read some of my journalism and he reached out to me one day and said, you know, maybe you'll hate it and maybe I won't like you and then we won't get along, but I would love for you to try to write on the show and become a staff writer on the show. So he reached out to me based on some of my journalism he'd read and asked me to come be a staff writer for the first season of Survivor's Remorse. And so I did that. I really loved the collaborative nature of it. Up until then, you know, the writing that I'd been doing, it's a very solitary exercise. It's just, you know,
you and your editor mostly.
Exactly. It's just you and your editor and mostly just you and your computer, you know? And so being in that room with a bunch of other writers that I really liked and admired and working with actors and directors and production designers and costume designers, all these people that make movies and TV shows work. That was just such a thrill to me. And it was like, I don't have to sit alone in my bedroom for hours on end. Like I can actually have conversations with people during the day. I fell in love with it and just started trying to, you know, I didn't work for another 8 months after that. And I almost gave up and went just back to being a full-time journalist. But after about 8 or 9 months of hitting the pavement and sort of looking and taking a lot of general meetings and meeting a lot of other people, I got my second show on The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. And so Larry Wilmore hired me.
We love Larry. Larry's great.
He's great. Larry's amazing. And he hired me to come be a writer on his Comedy Central show. And then it was working pretty consistently after that. And so
let me ask you a question. I might be interrupting you a little bit.
No, please, bro, you don't mind.
Yeah.
No, man, I'm a verbose person. So please tell me to shut up whenever.
Two things that I'm curious for you. Because one of the things that I get a sense of for you is not only can you write the most dramatic moments, you also can write the most funniest, hilarious, satirist, you know what I mean? Like you really felt that part. When you describe yourself as a writer, how do you describe yourself? Just curious.
I just say I'm a writer, man. I think that ignorance sometimes can help you in careers. And I think that when I came into this industry, I was ignorant of the fact that people, you know, some people consider themselves comedy writers and some people consider themselves drama writers. I didn't know that was just like a choice that people made. I was like, I'm a TV writer, so I just write TV, right? Like that's what life is. Life is neither comedy nor tragedy. It's frequently both of those things. So I can do both those things because I live a life that's both funny and sad. And so I never sort of like limited myself to one or the other. And so I think that that kind of helped me early in my career, because it allowed me to go from the nightly show with Larry Wilmore, sort of like this late night comedy show, to Master of None, which is kind of this dramedy half hour, to Watchmen, which is sort of like dramatic genre show, right? And to Succession, which is like a very funny hour long show. Like, it's just, there was just sort of I didn't realize that was strange to some people. I just felt like a writer is a writer, So I just call myself a writer.
When you're in the writer's room on a show, do you tend to pull back and give it a week or two to see how the rhythm goes, to figure out where your superpower or whatever you want to call it is going to exist? Or do you come on a show and when you meet the showrunner already get a sense of, and I know you're already now about to start doing your own shows, but as you were coming up, were you like figuring out your lane and like, oh, I'm strong in that? Like, what was your thing?
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important thing to understand, is that if you're working for a good showrunner understands that everybody brings something special to the room, and that it's, you know, the same way that a baseball manager doesn't want to hire 20 pitchers. A good showrunner isn't going to want to hire 20 people who do the exact same thing well, you know? And so, for instance, in the Good Place writer's room, that room was filled with some of the funniest people working in this industry. And it was filled with people who were stand-up comedians and, you know, improv graduates and people who had written for Saturday Night Live, like people whose entire thing was like, I want to be a comedy writer and I really love comedy. And like, it's, so there was people in there who were just punchline factories, were some of the funniest, quickest, sharpest, their ability to come up with jokes on the fly was just wild to me. I can't do that. That's never been my ability. But mm-hmm. I can write jokes. If you give me a few days to go off with a script and write it, I can do that. But just sort of like, as far as firing them off in a room, I can't do that. Right. Or at least I couldn't then. Maybe I can now. I don't know. But I realized that what The Good Place also needed was, you know, it's a show about philosophy. It's a show about sort of the ethics of the afterlife. It's a show with a lot of character development. It's a show with a lot of logic puzzles. And I was like, I'm very good with story. I'm very good with character. I think that these are things that I am good at. And so I just realized that, like, you know, when it comes to sort of like the pitch room, where it's just, we're punching up the punch up room, we're just pitching out jokes. That's not going to be my time to shine. I can pitch something every now and again here and there, but that's not really where my ability lies. My ability really lies. So it was like when we're talking about structure, when we're talking about character, when we're talking about sort of like the logic problems, when we're talking about the ethical philosophy and what we really want to say with the show, and what the themes of the show should be, that was when I was like, okay, here's where I'm more additive to this and where I can show my worth and value. So I think that it's important when you go into a writer's room, I think, to just be honest with yourself about what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't try to develop your skill set, whatever your weaknesses are, and get better at your weaknesses. But it just means being honest and saying, like, I may not be able to chip in the way that these writers are chipping in here, but I'm really good at this and I can do this really well. So I've always been focused on that when I'm in writers' rooms.
Yeah, and it's funny, because you'll be in a room and it's really easy, even no matter how good you are, to get imposter syndrome.
Especially when
you're surrounded by these beasts that are just
yeah. And especially when you're Black, you know. I think that especially when you are a Black, you know, we know that a lot of writers' rooms are very, very, very white still. You know, there is change, but there is still not a lot of diversity in some writers' rooms. And I think that it's very easy to feel like an imposter and feel like that imposter syndrome. And I think that it's important to realize that you are there for a reason. You were hired for a reason, and to, you know, make your voice heard. You know, when I first started out, I was very afraid to talk up in a writer's room. You know, I was nervous because I was like, especially that first writer's room, because I was in there working with writers who've been doing stuff for years. You know,
you went in there cold too. Nobody told you how to do it. So
exactly. And so it was like, I was very afraid to talk, but I realized, like, at a certain point, it's like, you got to remind yourself, you're here for a reason. You were hired for a reason. They want to hear your ideas. They value your brain. And so that to me was always helpful in helping getting over the imposter syndrome. Was like, they hired me because they want me here. And so I need to acknowledge that I'm here for a reason and make my voice heard.
Right, right. I can't have you on here without talking about Watchmen.
Yes, please.
You know, you wrote my favorite episode. I know we talked about this once.
Thank you. Yeah.
You know, I'm sure everybody tells you about it. It's personal to me, because like 8 years ago, I wrote a Black Wall Street script that gets me in any room. And yeah. It takes place over just the 24 hours, you know, wow. happening after, you know, yeah. the aftermath of it all. And when I saw the way you guys did it, I was like, they're on the right track of where I want to go. You know what yeah. I mean? Minus the sci-fi and all the other stuff.
Absolutely.
But the in your faceness of about it, if that makes sense, you know what I mean? The it felt like a horror movie when it came
yeah.
out. And that is the feeling that I know that team and that staff, you know, put together there, that it's like all of a sudden it goes from this, you know, this movie where there's all these beautiful, successful, you know, Black folks living better than some of the white folks to holy shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Bomb has dropped.
Yeah. I mean, literally.
Yeah. Literally. Anybody can go and nobody's safe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, I just had to say that just really quick. But what was it like working on in that room for you?
That was a real, real privilege. And I feel like I learned so much. You know, the two guys who have really, really supported me in the industry, you know, besides I've had like really, really great bosses. Sure. Mike O'Malley, who hired me for Survivor's Remorse. Larry Wilmore, who hired me for the Nightly Show. Yeah. And then Mike Schur and Damon Lindelof have also been really supportive. And Damon, to me, to this day, is a really, really good friend and a mentor of mine. And so I was a huge fan of The Leftovers. Mm-hmm. I loved The Leftovers so much, particularly season two. I mean,
crazy.
When Regina King was there, it was just like sort of, and Jovan Adepo, like I just really sort of like fell in love with that show in a very real way. I loved season one, but I especially loved season two, and I was just obsessed with it. And so when I met Damon about 3 weeks after the series finale had aired for that show, and told him that I was a huge fan, and he emailed me about a month later and said, would you be interested in talking about Watchmen? I'd never read Watchmen. And ooh. so Damon said, that's okay. It's, you know, it's kind of what I was saying earlier about like, sometimes ignorance is good. Damon said, I know Watchmen backward and forward. Mm-hmm. You don't have to know about it. I'm actually interested. It's kind of what I was saying again about children. I'm interested in the fact that you don't know anything about it, because right. you can come into it with your own perspective on it that might be different and great compared to what my perspective is on it. And so I went into that room knowing that I was there for a reason. And I think that I just learned so much, not just from Damon, but just we had like a murderer's row of writers in there, you know, yeah, Janine sure. Ambers and mm-hmm. Stacey Asekufor and Leela Bai, just people whose work I really, really admired from afar for a while. And so and then I think that what really helped me in that room was the first adaptation I'd ever worked on.
Oh, okay.
And I think that I, you know, in that the film that I made is an adaptation.
Right.
I learned so much in that room about adapting a book that I applied to the script when I was writing American Fiction. And that is one of the big lessons that I really took away that Damon kept harping on was he would say, listen, we are building a world. So we sort of like, we can do whatever we want. We sort of, everything that happened in the original Watchmen happened, but we're adding brand new characters. We're putting it in a brand new place. We're sort of like adding this kind of imagined history also. And mm-hmm. so it was like, we are blue skying and we're going crazy. Mm-hmm. Every writer knows that looking at a blank page is both exciting and terrifying.
Right.
It's exciting because you can do anything you want, but it's also terrifying because you can do anything you want. And it's like, how do I even start, right? How do I even begin this thing when I can do anything that I want? It can be paralyzing. And so in order to sort of like get over that paralysis and help us sort of like have some structure, Damon would say, we can do anything as long as it feels Watchmen. He would say, we all sort of like have a feeling that this book gives us, and sort of like we understand the emotion that is drawn out of you when you read it. Mm-hmm. And so you'd pitch something, and sometimes Damon would say, you know, that's a fine pitch, but it doesn't feel Watchmen. It doesn't feel like this. It doesn't feel like the essence. Right. It doesn't feel like the spirit of the original. And we want to maintain the spirit of the original in ours, even though ours is going to be wildly different. And right. so that to me was something that I really thought a lot about when it came to writing American Fiction, was the idea that you have this book that you love, but you need to change it pretty drastically in order to make it a movie, you know, and you can't sort of hew so closely to the text. You have to make some decisions that are going to change things. And so I endeavored to do that while maintaining the spirit of what the novel was, and maintaining the essence of what Percival Everett, who wrote Erasure, was trying to do. And in fact, you know, he told me after the fact, but one of the reasons that I was afraid to approach Percival is because he had said no to other people who wanted to come along to adapt this book. He had denied people the rights.
And what do you think you did or said that grabbed him?
What he told me after the fact was we spoke for about a half an hour before he gave me the rights, and what he said afterward was, he said, I thought you understood the spirit of the novel. He said, I could tell. He said that I could tell that in our conversation you understood the spirit of what I was trying to do, and I knew that you would be able to capture the spirit even if you changed a lot of the story, that you knew what I was endeavoring to do. And so when he told me that was probably the greatest compliment that I received on the script, was that he felt like I was able to capture what he was attempting to do, even though it was different in a lot of ways, you know, and I think that's the key.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things I'm always telling writers when you're trying to adapt something from something real, you know, like I get asked to do a lot of bio projects, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm always looking at is you can't always tell a cradle to the grave story, right?
No.
How do you just focus on that part of the, like the new Ferrari movie, you know what I mean? Like he just focused on that summer, that 4 months, 1957.
Exactly.
When Ferrari was going through this thing. And it's like, you can do the cradle, but when you do, you're really sticking by the numbers. You
exactly.
know? And so, exactly. So I like what you're talking about, because it forces you to focus on what is the through line that's moving me. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly.
And how does that thread only work within this part of the story? You know,
exactly.
And it feels like the entire book. You know,
exactly.
It's hard exactly. to do, but if you really lean in, you can find it. You know,
no, I totally agree. And that's very, I feel that, you know, that is, you know, speaking of Jeffrey Wright, like I love Basquiat. Like I really like that movie. And I think that's another one that does that really well. It's like not Basquiat from Birth to Death. It's from Basquiat at this very specific moment in his life when he's sort of like ascending to fame and sort of like what that does to him. And I think that's one of my favorite Jeffrey performances ever, but I have yet tried to write a biopic. I think that it seems incredibly challenging, but I think that it's always, the ones that I consume and enjoy, I think I always enjoy the ones a little bit more that just really focus on a specific moment in time for this person. Mm-hmm. And sort of like I think one of the most brilliant biopic scripts is Jobs, right? Is that Aaron Sorkin script, and just this idea that you can capture so much of an essence of a person just in three different speeches that they give, right? Like the moments before this big speech. And I think that's sort of like the magic trick of that, of allowing you to understand who this person is mm-hmm. over the course of their life based just on, you know, the half hour before they're supposed to give this tremendous speech in their career. Like that is just, I love that stuff. I think it's just such a great sleight of hand and a really nice way to encapsulate these things.
It's like I spent, before we went on strike, I spent the last year working as number two with Ben Watkins.
Oh yeah.
So I helped him staff like a couple shows and all that.
Oh, amazing. So
it was fascinating to me because one of the things we have in common is we both write underdog stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I write underdog stories in the murder, death, kill world that deal with redemption.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I'm always trying to find, you know, so whenever people bring me in, I'm like, ooh, if we focused on her character though.
Yeah.
She's the underdog. So I think it's one of the things I loved about, you know, what you did with Monk is he is an underdog character. You know what
exactly.
I mean? Not
exactly.
as successful as he could be. Clearly he's a genius and bright and all that other stuff. And that what he ends up doing is super easy to him. Yeah. That's the easy way to go. He's trying to challenge you. Be like, exactly. No, look at this. Look at how much better this thing is. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And everybody's like, no, we can care less. Give us a shaft. Give us a regular.
Yeah. And I think that's what Jeffrey does. It's hard to play a lovable grump.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to write somebody who's as antagonistic as Monk is, and sort of like still keep the audience on that character's side. Because there's a world in which the audience just from the beginning says, well, this guy's a jerk. I don't care about him. Who cares? I'm not rooting for him. And then you lose them instantly. And I think that what I tried to sprinkle in there was this, you know, was the understanding that I had this great therapist one time who told me that.
Wait. Black people go to therapy?
Black people should go to therapy. Believe me, I'll tell you, black people should go to therapy as much as possible. Therapy should be free for black people, I promise.
I agree.
No, please. And so I had this great therapist who said once that she said anger is a secondary emotion, and that for especially for men,
mm-hmm.
anger is always hiding either pain or fear. And that sort of like underneath these angry outbursts is either pain or fear. And that men, especially, are afraid to say, like for me, it used to be the hardest thing in the world for me to say to somebody, you hurt my feelings when you did this.
Mm.
Because that to me was not masculine to say. It was not right. masculine to admit, this hurt right. my feelings. It was not masculine to admit, like, I'm afraid, this makes me fearful, right? And sort of like, and so instead of admitting that you're feeling these things, you just like chest thump and say like, well, I'm loud and I'm aggressive and I'm not afraid and I certainly, you can't hurt me. And so I think the thing that I really wanted to make sure to include in the film and a thing that I tried to write in and a thing that I think that Jeffrey latched onto and really sort of brought through in his performance was one of the things that really keeps you on Monk's side is mm-hmm. you see the pain underneath his anger, right? Like you see he's frustrated. He's arguing with his students. He's arguing with his colleagues. He's arguing with his family. He's arguing with his girlfriend. Like, this is a guy who's arrogant and arguing constantly with everybody and picking fights constantly.
I know people like him.
Yeah, exactly. But what keeps you on his side is that, like, you see that he's hurt. You just see that you see the hurt underneath that anger. And it's like, that is what I really wanted to make sure to incorporate in the writing of the film was that not just a jerk, but a jerk who had a real humanity and depth to him. And the reason he's angry is because he's in so much pain.
So this is, you know, the Writers Guild podcast. So can you tell us a little bit about how you adapted, you know, the book into a screenplay for one, and how long did it take you to write it? And once you got to that position, did you go to your reps? Did they look at it? How did you guys finally get it out and start, you know, pitching it and whatnot?
Yeah. So the first thing I found this book, through happenstance, I was reading a book review for a different book and it mentioned this book in the review and sounded interesting to me. And so I went out and picked it up and I just intended to read it over no intention of adapting. Just, I was like, it was Christmas of 2020 and I was like, I'll read it over the holiday break and just, you know, just a fun reading exercise. But the minute I started reading it, I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. This is really speaking to me. And it was like, within 50 pages, I was like, maybe I want to write the script and adapt this. I think that there's something to this. It was really resonating with me so deeply in a way that no piece of art had before or since. And so I sort of devoured it and quickly reached out to my manager and said, hey, you read this and see what you think. I think I might have sent him my copy or bought him a copy. I don't remember, but he went and read it himself. And he said, I think I agree with you. I think that there's something here. And so then we reached out to his agent and his agent said, Percival wants to have a conversation with Cord for about for a little bit. And so I think he and I talked mid-January. And as I said, the conversation went well enough. And he said, I think you understand the spear well enough that he gave me the rights for free for 6 months. He said, I really think that you understand it. And so you can have the rights for free for 6 months, which is, you know, rights conversations can take months, if not years sometimes. And so him giving me that.
And you're a busy writer as it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so him giving me that was just like really incredible. But then I'm a pretty slow writer. So it took, you know, I think that it took me about 4 months to write the script. I don't write fast. I'm pretty, you know, I know people who say that they can write scripts in like a week. That's never been my ability. And so, particularly things that aren't outlined or anything. So just from sort of like this, beginning of the writing process to the end was about 4 months. And then we got it done. So then that was probably May of 2021. And then we took it out to producers and we sold it in July of 2021. And then it was.
Did you have to give it back to him first?
Yeah, that was he asked before he officially gave us the rights to send to producers. He said, I want to read the script. And so that's the one thing with saying you can have the rights for free until you're done with the script, right? Is like because now all of a sudden he doesn't have to give you written the script and he can say like, actually, I hate this. No. And so it was a very, very nerve-wracking 48 hours while I waited for him to read the script. But he read the script. Mm-hmm. He gave us the approval. And then we were kind of off. Then we sort of paid him. And then we were off to the races with the rest.
Yeah, I see he got like producer credit and stuff, which I respect. I think that's great. You know?
Yeah, man. This movie doesn't exist without him. You know what I mean? I feel like everybody should get their due. And I'm happy that he got his due. Percival's since become a really good friend and a mentor of mine.
Now he's so, like, what other one do you want to do?
Yeah, Corey? Exactly. Yeah. Well, he's actually talking about us writing something together, which I'm very excited about. Yeah, right. Yeah.
That'd be dope. Let me ask you, how long was the shoot?
26 days.
Wow. Okay.
Very sure. We were supposed to have 27, but we ended up with 26. So it was very run and gun. We didn't have a lot of time on our hands.
And you ended up doing it, was it Boston or somewhere? What was it?
Boston, yeah. We did some LA rather, but mostly Boston.
Okay.
So the college stuff, and obviously the final shot of the movie is in LA. Right. But the rest of it was in Boston.
Right. Because I'm one of those people, you know, as a producer, I'm always looking at production value and looking at like, oh, I could tell this movie was probably this much money. I could just see it. Yeah. You know, it's just one of those things. And so like when you guys went to the beach, and as soon as you guys got there and stayed there for a while, I was going, okay, this budget went up quite a bit all of a sudden for me. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, wait a minute. They're on the beach on the beach.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was like, I thought they were like adjacent, like down the street.
No.
I was like, okay, Cord, I see you on your line. Y'all know
how to play. Yeah, we did a lot of beach scouting. We found like we had some great location scouts. We had some great production designers. We had a great cinematographer. We had people who really, really helped us punch above our weight class visually and sort of with the aesthetics of the film, who really made it look more expensive than it was. And one of the producers is actually from that town. It's called Scituate, Massachusetts. It's about sort of, southeast of Boston, about 40 minutes. Okay. And he grew up in Scituate. Actually, the house that we used for the family beach house, for the family cottage, was his old high school art teacher's house. We were location scouting, and she comes out and she goes, is that little Ben LeClaire? And it was like, yep. I'm producing now, and we ended up using her house for that, and we fortunately got the one across the street for Coraline's house as well.
Before I let you go, because they're telling me we got to wrap up, I have just two quick things for you. One,
yes sir,
I love the relationship between the older couple, and I knew
Aaron Lorraine, yeah,
I knew it was coming. I told my husband this, which I thought was funny. I said, we were watching it, and I said, and he turned, and he was watching it. She went back in the house. He went, and I went, that is a black man. That is a black man who knows what he wants. Okay. I grew up in the 70s in the Bay Area.
Exactly. With
all the Black Panthers and all that. They would have saw a girl went, and I was like, yes, Cord, yes, keep that in the show.
Exactly. Exactly. So
I just appreciated that relationship also, not to give anything.
Thank you.
But because it was so real, they look like real people, you know, and
yes,
to me,
sir.
I appreciated that.
Thank you.
The other thing was, as a gay man, I actually appreciated what you did with your boy's character, with Clip. I thought that was pretty amazing. The type, you didn't dwell in his gayness, you know, I forget what the line was, but I remember me and my husband broke out in tears when he was having that final moment with his brother, with Monk. With Monk, my apologies.
Yeah, no worries.
And, And he was telling him about how dad died not knowing who he really truly was.
Yeah.
And his line back to Monk about why it was important for him to know.
Oh man.
It was just beautiful.
Thank you. That is so a lot of that is taken directly from my real life. So I'm not gay, but my mother died 8 years ago. And one of my biggest regrets in my life is that there was a lot of myself that I hid from my mother, either because I thought she'd be disappointed in me, or I thought that that it was embarrassing or shameful for me to admit these things. And I really, really regret that now because that is something that I think to myself, is that she never knew who I fully was and she never will. And that really makes me sad. I think that one of the main themes of this movie is freedom and what a lack of freedom does to people. And when people feel not free to be themselves, the crazy thing is that they'll do to act out because they don't feel free, you know, and sort of like what that does to a person's psyche and what that does to their behavior. And so I think that for me, the two characters who I think resemble me the most, there's a little bit of me in everybody, but it's Cliff and Monk. And I think that it's these guys who have, you know, which is why I think that, again, not to give too much away, but I think the real love story in the film is between Cliff and Monk. And it's these guys who, for different reasons, have built up these facades in front of themselves. And they've been hiding. They hide themselves from the world. And they don't tell everybody exactly who they are and exactly what they've been feeling. And so I think in some ways, one of the things that frustrates Monk about Cliff is that he's seeing a guy who's finally becoming who he wants to be. And sort of like, yeah, it's a bumpy road. And, you know, he's going through a midlife crisis. Like, that's what Cliff is doing. It's like the same way that we've seen a million guys divorce their wives and start dating younger people and get their ear pierced and buy a convertible BMW or whatever.
Like, he came out late. Is that what it is?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like,
I know a lot of dudes like him. Yeah.
So he's just come out. He's in the middle of his divorce. He's in the middle of all this and he's trying to figure out who he wants to be and like actually live in his truth. And I think that that's one of the things that upsets Monk about Cliff. It's like, yeah, Cliff is kind of a pain in the ass sometimes, but what he also resents is that Cliff is finally becoming who he wants to be. And he's living out in the open and he's saying like, this is who I am. And so that moment that they're having when he's saying like, man, I see what you're doing. Game recognized game here. And I see that you're living, you're not being honest with yourself. You're not being honest with the people around you. And like, that really is eventually going to break you. That's going to hurt you the way that it hurt our father. You know, I think that to me was one of the most important parts of the movie. And it's one of the things that's really, really a part of, you know, if I had made this movie 5 years ago, I would not have, it would have been a very different movie. And I would not have made it
you matured yourself. So
yeah. Man, five years ago, I was Monk. 5 years ago, I was Monk and Cliff. I was not honest with anybody. I was not honest with myself. I was really, 2018 was this crazy year where I had a lot of career success and I was writing on Watchmen. I was writing Succession. I was writing on The Good Place. I was having all this career success and I was also feeling at the same time profoundly depressed. And it was like, how are all these good things going on in my life? And yet I feel miserable all the time. And I finally started going to therapy, finally started sort of like getting serious about being honest with people and being honest with myself and trying to get past my own problems. And it changed my life the way that it's sort of like, you can see it change Cliff's life in the movie as well. And, you know, eventually, hopefully Monk's life. So there's a lot of me in there. And those two characters in particular are very, very close to my heart.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Cord, man. So good.
Thank you, man. It's so great talking to you too. Hey, I want to ride Vespas one day.
Let's get it.
I'm still desperate.
I got six of them in my garage.
So. Are you serious? You have six? Yeah.
You see one of them right there behind me? Look, that's me. So, yeah, man, well, I appreciate you, buddy. Hey, quick question. Can people follow you? Where are you at? Are you on Instagram, Twitter?
I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Twitter less these days. I had my friend lock me out of my Twitter account because my skin's too thin to see what people are saying about me in the movie on Twitter right now. So I'll probably get back on there one day, but you can follow me there. I'm on Cord Jefferson and then I'm on Instagram. I check Instagram a lot more. I'm a Cord Jefferson on there as well. So
awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, everybody.
Well, thank you.
Follow us at WJ West everywhere. You could find us out there. I'm at Hilliard Guest. Thank you again to Greg and the whole team over here and your team who helped us put this together. Thank you, Michelle.
No, thank you, man. And thank you to everybody.
Thanks
really
again,
Corey.
All the best on this movie, man. Go see this movie and shout out to Issa again. So love y'all.
Shout out to Issa and shout out to the WGA. I love you guys. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon.
See y'all.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Third and Fairfax. You can listen and subscribe to Third and Fairfax on Spotify, Apple, and Libsyn. And now watch us on the Writers Guild of America West YouTube channel. Also check out writtenby.com, the Guild's newly relaunched online publication. See you next time.
I walked up to her front door. She works at the plant like everybody else.
So the song Hands came about at a time I was working and living in Tupelo, Mississippi. This was be the late 70s, probably 79. And I'm organizing in sort of the north from Jackson up to Memphis, that northern part of the state. And so there's a town south of Tupelo, Houston, Mississippi, very small town in Chickasaw County, very rural, had a furniture plant. And a lot of people farmed, or one member of the family farmed and the other worked in the plant kind of thing. So I went down there to organize that plant. And so for some background, the first thing I did, there were two local unions in Chickasaw County, a paper workers local and a glass and ceramic workers local. So of course I'm gonna go meet with the presidents of those two locals before I do anything else. So I met with the head of the paper workers and learned that he didn't know the president of the glass and ceramic workers. This kind of blew my mind, and he wasn't telling me why. I later learned that the head of the glass and ceramic workers local was also the head of the Ku Klux Klan. And the paper worker guy was progressive. So then that made sense. It was also in his house, and this relates to one of the lines in the song Hands. So when you're an organizer, you go into somebody's house, you're tuning all your five basic senses into everything. What's hanging on the wall? What smell is coming from the kitchen? You know, all this stuff. So I'm sitting there talking with the guy who's president of the local, and you know, his wife was there. She wasn't saying anything. Talked for like 45 minutes. And I said, well, I see a hymnal there on your piano. I'm Catholic, and that looks like a Catholic hymnal. And she then spoke up. She said, I knew there was a third strike against you. You're Yankee, you're Union, and you're Catholic. And they will hang you in Chickasaw County for that. So, you know, I'm like, you know, 25 years old, 24 years old. And I'm like, holy shit, what's going on here? So that's just a little backdrop. It was like going back in time. And of course, there's no GPS. So finding these people who live out in rural areas was really hard. You got to go do house calls. Well, I found Pam. I knew Pam had worked in the plant. And I went to house call her. And her husband, Roy, answered the door. And I said, well, I'm here to talk to Pam about a union at the plant. And he turns and points to a big gun rack that was right by the front door. He said, if you're here to talk about the union, that's what you're going to meet. And he points to his guns. Now, leaning up against the gun rack was a guitar. And so I shifted the conversation immediately to the guitar. And I said, oh, I play. In fact, I got my guitar in the car. And that got me an invitation in. That got me into his house, where I talked with Pam, and then we played music together, the three of us, and became really good friends. So this song is really about Pam and Roy and meeting them. And I took a line from a Stuart Acuff poem called Hands. It really didn't lend itself to a song, but it did have the line,
She sat down and looked at her hands. Sore and thick from a hard day at work.
Now that is, first of all, when you're talking to somebody about something as uncomfortable as maybe losing their job, they do kind of sit and look at their hands. Sore and thick, you have to have worked to understand that your hands do get sore and thick. So I built a song around that hook in Stewart's poem. And it really is about sort of asking if I could come in and sit down. And, you know, she's looking at her hand, she's worried. But there's a little more to it. And that is the way I recorded it was, you know, really special to me. I've always believed, you know, what Carlos Santana always said, the tone to a musician is first and foremost. And I think that's true in life as well. You know, you've heard the saying that people may not remember what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel. That's tone. And so I've always applied that in all of my work and in my music. And so this song opens with a big, full, lush guitar chord played through a Frantone Vibutron tremolo.
I walked up to her front door.
Now, only guitar heads would appreciate that, but it sounds like a Hammond B3 organ. It's got that modulation to it, and that chord just hangs at the beginning, and then we go into the song. It's also a song that has instruments that actually talk to one another. And, you know, there are plenty of artists that do that, but there are more that don't. More typical, you have a verse, then a solo, then a verse or a chorus, then another solo. But in this one, I play a melodic solo on the acoustic guitar, and Tom Espinola is playing mandolin, and he's dancing all around that solo, which to me, I mean, that just that draws me in.
That raised her family. Listening with every part of me. Talking about how dignity can be found in a fight.
I think the key to this song is what was happening in Mississippi at that time, my union organizing, and the idea of, and this is in the chorus starts with the line, listening with every part of me. That's what an organizer does. And that's all, it's more than listening. Like I said, it's all of the basic senses as all pathways to the soul. But listening with every part of me, talking about how dignity can be found in a fight, standing for what you know is right. That's the chorus. That's kind of the key to the song. The verses set that up. And that's essentially the, you know, why and how I wrote Hands.
My car and drove on home. Picked up my guitar and sat down. I wrote a song about about working on the other side of town. Listening with every part of me. Talking about how dignity can be found in a fight. Standing for what you know is right.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1805. That was the day that abolitionist and women's rights advocate Angelina Grimke was born. Her parents were slaveholders and among the wealthiest in Charleston, South Carolina. As a young woman, she denounced slavery and together with her sister Sarah moved north to Philadelphia to join the Quakers. There she became a teacher and grew frustrated with how the Quakers approached abolitionism. She quickly gravitated towards radical abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison and became active in the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society. She became prominent in abolitionist circles in 1835 after Garrison published her letter condemning pro-slavery riots in Boston. The next year, she published an open letter to Southern women demanding they condemn the institution of slavery. Angelina and Sarah embarked on abolitionist speaking tours and the organizing of women's anti-slavery societies. Having grown up in the South, the Grimke sisters held a special authority among Northern abolitionists. They could testify to the severity and inhumanity of the slave system. They did so in the book American Slavery As It Is, written together with Angelina's husband, abolitionist Theodore Well. Controversy intensified against Angelina and her sister as their popularity grew. Religious leaders and abolitionists alike bristled at the idea of women engaging in public speaking and political work. Undeterred, the sisters defended their right to be on equal footing with men in the abolitionist movement. Harriet Beecher Stowe's sister Catherine, a leading educator, was among those who decried women's public activism. Angelina responded that all humans are moral beings worthy of human rights, regardless of gender. Her response served as an early contribution to the women's rights movement of the 19th century.
So that's your hit of Power Hour for the day. In this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour. If you got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. info@laborheritage.org. That's info@laborheritage.org.
The Labor Heritage Power Hour, a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Find out more about us, laborradionetwork.org. Hey, before we go, just a reminder, we're wrapping up our winter pledge drive this week. And at least I was thinking that, you know, the kind of voices that we put on the show every week, like today with Cord Jefferson, you know, our good friend Joe Uline, and all the other shows across the station that make it such a valuable resource for the community. But that's only possible because of the support of our listeners, right?
Absolutely correct. As it should be, because we don't have to depend on corporate power and corporate dollars to bring you the truth and the bread and the roses, the culture and the music and the songs and the videos and the films. That's what this is about. And you make that happen.
And you make that happening by going to your phone and picking it up and giving us a call right now. 1-800-222-9739 or go online, WPFWFM.org. You can give in Cash App, $WPFW, or just give us a call, 800-222-9739. 9. It's that easy and really makes a difference, folks. Any last words, Elise, before we wrap up for the week?
We bring you the best, and we hope you enjoy it and appreciate your support.
Revolutionary Radio for Revolutionary Times, right here on the Labor Heritage Power Hour. Thanks so much for listening, folks. Great to have you back, Elise.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be back.
And why don't you give our signature outro line?
Oh, thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, the art and soul of the American labor movement.
We'll see you next week, everybody.